style of the passage is going to change a little bit for us here tonight as we're going to move into a an allegory, but it's also a everybody get one? It's a kind of a song format, a poetic format. As we'll see, it's got two parts to it, though they are very similar and really probably the same thing in both of them, but two different parts that go with it. The on your sheet there, I got a little bit of an introduction type of thing to it for that. That it's a song style. It's a dirge lamenting the state of things in the royal household during the final days of Judah's decline. Remember, that's what the whole book has been pretty much about. Where that second Babylonian invasion captivity part, Ezekiel and others were taken into exile into Babylon, and but he's talking about things back in Jerusalem, and back in Judea, and how bad it is, and how much worse it's going to get. And we're going to see that in the next few chapters, that, that there's really not much hope for those folks back there. Those in exile actually going to have it better. They don't see that at this point. But he's going to talk about that, and he's going to use these two different formats. One is a lioness and her cubs, and that's the first 9 verses, and then 10 through 14, he talks about a vine and its branches. And both of these were familiar images in Judah, for Judah and for Israel, as we'd say, and depicting the nation. And we'll see them used in this this passage here tonight. So let's start and pick up and read the first 9 verses, this first part of this on the lioness. And if you look at your sheet there, down below it, I've got a little chart way down at the bottom of your sheet there as far as breaking down the kings and the age, father, mother, reign, and that, because there's some controversy. I did realize this afternoon I left off in the under the father for Mattaniah or Zedekiah. It's still Josiah is the father there. But so if you want to just add that to, or just same as the, not the one right above, but the two up above that. But would somebody like to start off and read 1 through 9 for us?
And you take up a lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, what was your mother? A lioness. Among lions she crouched. In the midst of young lions she reared her cubs. And she brought up one of her cubs. He became a young lion, and he learned to catch prey. He devoured men. The nations heard about him. Was caught in their pit, and they brought him with hooks to the land of Egypt. When she saw that she waited in vain, that her hope was lost, she took another of her cubs and made him a young lion. He prowled among the lions. He became a young lion, and he learned to catch prey. He devoured men and seized their widows. He laid waste their cities, and the land was appalled, and all who were in it at the sound of his roaring. Then the nations set against him from provinces on every side. They spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit. With hooks they put him in a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into custody that his voice should no more be heard on the mountains of Israel.
Okay. Why do you think the Ezekiel uses a lion or a lioness as an imagery here? Okay, yeah, Judah was a lion, right? The Lion of Judah. That imagery goes way back into Genesis, that and the predictions there. And so it's not surprising to use this. And we're talking about this woman, a queen, who takes her sons, and we have, let's see, a couple of them that are put upon the throne. And gives her the credit for. Again, this is an allegory, so we're not looking for all the details of being exactly what this is, but it's telling us a story. Painting a picture, and I want us to think a little bit about what is the bottom line of this story as we go through. But let's look at some of the details that are in this account. And I've kind of outlined this down on your handout there if you want to follow along with that. I said the lioness and her cubs, the story is told in an allegorical form. One is chosen to lead the people, and I think there's pretty much agreement this is Jehoahaz. And so if you look down the chart, he took the throne when he was 23 years old. His father was Josiah, who was, of course, a good king, but Jehoahaz was not. Mother was Hamutah. But he only reigned for 3 months. But look what it says about him in the passage. That she brought one of her cubs, this is verse 3, he became a young lion and he learned to catch prey. He devoured men. Okay, so he learned wickedness, really. He was a wicked king, is what it's saying about us. He behaved as, I think it was Ian Duguid said, in lion-like fashion, tearing the prey and even consuming the people. He only ruled for 3 months, and then he was taken captive and exiled into Egypt. Okay? And then the Egyptian Pharaoh put somebody else upon the throne, and that second person he put upon the throne was, we call him Jehoiakim normally, or Eliakim, and he would take over as as reigning over Judah. Now he was one, and we've talked about him a good bit already in this book of Ezekiel, but he vacillated back and forth, or tried to at least, between Egypt and Babylon, which one was going to not make him pay as much tribute, and which was going to protect him at times. So he's put on the throne by Egypt, but then before long he favors Babylon against Egypt. And then and that doesn't work. He tries to go back to Egypt and back and forth some, and just creating a lot of turmoil within the people, the land, and a lot of danger for that nation. When you don't hold your ground on anything, you're vacillating back and forth all of the time. And that's one of the things that he did. He reigned for 11 years there. And that in 2 Kings 23, we read some of this. Most of this is found in 2 Kings 23, 24, and 25. I'm going to hit a few parts of it for us here tonight. Not everything, but in 23:31, it talks about how he was put upon the throne. It says, "And Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, and the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he imposed on the land a fine of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold." So put Jehoiakim on there. It goes on to talk about Pharaoh Necho made Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king in his place. So we see that. You see that they had the same father but different mothers. Okay? Jehoiakim's mother was Zedadah. Okay? All right. What we find then is that he did reign for 11 years. But then he's removed from, the first one was removed, and then he's put on the throne. We go back to the passage. In verse 5 it says, when she saw that she waited in vain and that her hope was lost, the other son's been taken captive, she took another of her cubs and made him a young lion, and he prowled among the lions. He became a young lion. And he learned to catch prey. He devoured men, and he seized their widows. He laid waste their cities, and the land was appalled, and all who were in it at the sound of his roaring. So he again was a wicked king. The question comes in this allegory: who is the second king? And on your sheet there, I put that little section there that question about it. You had a Jehoiakim. Was that the one there? If you look, he's the next king. We just talked about him. He's going to reign for 11 years. But is that who they're talking about? Because it says that this queen, this mother, puts another one of her sons. Well, if you notice, they have different mothers. And so is that the one? Or some people think it was Jehoiachin who became is the next one. Of course, again, you have a different mother. But if you go all down to Zedekiah, you have the same mother. And so some people think it's Zedekiah that's become is that next one that's there. I put on that little sheet there a couple of different things about them, but Derek Thomas in his commentary says he thinks it's Jehoiakim, the very next king. Ian Duguid, very interesting, says he believes that it was Jehoiachin if the two images in this are the same, but if they're not, then he thinks it was Zedekiah. So just kind of depending on how you interpret one part to understand the other part. And that's typical of an allegory, what you put in it and the intention. My point is, and what I want to bring out, is what is the message of it all? What is it telling us? What's happening in this that we're trying to learn from? Not necessarily who it is. Thoughts, comments?
He's trying to show them something of what happened in the past, the spiral down into wickedness and the causes of their sacking of Jerusalem and departure into exile.
Exactly. We're seeing how these kings just continue in this wickedness and instead of turning to the Lord, instead of trusting God, they trust in, in Egypt or in Babylon, wherever they think they're going to get the best deal, that's where they're going to go. Never turning back to God, never going back to Him. And we see this spiral going down. And one king gets replaced, well, the next king comes and he just continues in the evil ways again. And just goes on and on. And this is he's setting up a justification, really, for the Babylonian exile that is there in the midst of, that's taking place. And this is was leading into that exile. Taking place. Okay? You see that?
Who is setting up these kings? Is it if you got a bad king and people around him realize it's bad, and they get to the point where they say, well, we just had enough of this. We can't do it anymore.
Right.
And then I guess, okay, well, what goes on then? Who chooses the next king? And I guess it's not them choosing, it's somebody choosing for them, I guess.
Yeah, and the allegory talks about the mother doing that, whoever that mother's representing. You got a couple of facts. That's a very good question on that, too. If you had in the northern kingdom, which is no longer in existence at this time, but in the northern kingdom where you had the kings were not descendants of David, and so it was really just a power. If you killed the king, then you might become the next king, or somebody else would, and it was all power, just who had the upper hand in that. In Judah, it was always a descendant of David, and that's why you have brothers and uncles and other ones being put into that throne. They kept the David line that was there, but again, it was still a lot of power, just who was in power. Or in the case where Jehoiakim became king, Egypt came in and they took Jehoahaz and took him away to Egypt, exiled him to Egypt, and they said, okay, this other brother son of Josiah, but a brother of his, is going to become the next king. So Egypt is the actual hand that did it there, but it was Egypt. Egypt was the hand that did it, that made that decision, but they did keep it within the same family. Now, sometimes it wasn't always. Sometimes it's Babylon. When Babylon comes in and replaces him, then they put somebody else in the king. So it kind of varied, but it's really it's always a power struggle. There's no doubt about that. But it's just where that power was a foreign agent or whether it was more local. But in Judah, it stayed always within the family line.
But it never got to the point where when they had that evil, where people rebelled and wanted to turn back to the righteousness of those same. It seemed like...
Sadly not, that's right.
Still, that's okay, this one's bad. We've got another one here, and he might just be as bad. We'll see, try him a while.
Yeah, sometimes we have better kings put on. Josiah, for instance, when he came on, he was heard the Lord and was a godly person. And when he did that, there was a revival that takes place within the land. But when he gets killed, then quickly the next king comes in, and sadly, the people follow the king, pretty much.
That's a lot of things, too, like our culture, too. I mean, everything kind of goes downstream from our culture. Mm-hmm. our schools, everything. Everybody thinks, well, you just send them to a good school, they'll be all right. No, because the culture controls the school. And, you know, when we look at, we have a good king, and then we sit there, and or we have one that doesn't do what we hope to do. You know, either the people rebel, they say, okay, we won't. God's got to give us a God of a king, somebody that's going to, or we're just going to continue on the way we're going. You know, it's like, if we're not looking to God, so that's what happens. We end up getting what we deserve.
Right. Well, Sid, you want to say?
I was going to say, it seems to me, it was always from the top down. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm trying to think, was there ever a time when, I mean, when the people demanded Saul, way back when.
Right.
They were in rebellion when they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Manasseh was one of the most wicked kings.
Right. Declared the most
he
wicked.
Said and the scripture says he caused Israel to sin more than the Canaanites under the conquest.
Right.
I mean, that's...
Yeah.
And yet he repented. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was saying the same thing. I can't think of any time where the people, there was an uprising, in Judah at least, and they overthrew the king and then did it. It was always was from the top down. Maybe it was a foreign power, but from the top down.
They were just so easy to lead. I mean, they would do whatever.
It did seem to be that way, you know, just very compliant with it.
The kings also would have their armies, so if they were, they didn't have a big enough rebellion, you know.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's a danger. Always dangerous to start a rebellion.
Right. And it's not like they voted or anything.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that would have kept it all fair.
Yeah, really.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's a good question, Jack. And I think it does help us to understand a little bit more of what's going on here and how the power struggle is taking place. All right? Okay. Let's look at the second. We'll come back and do a little more analysis of it. But starting in verse 10... we have the second part of the allegory, or second allegory, you might say, which takes us now from the lion picture to the picture of the vine. Again, it was a common description of Israel being the vine of the Lord, his vineyard, and that. So would somebody like to pick up at 10 and read through 14?
Your mother was like a vine in your bloodline, planted by the waters, fruitful and full of branches because of many waters. She had strong branches for scepters of rulers. She towered in stature above the thick branches and was seen in her height amid the dense foliage. But she was plucked up in fury and was cast down to the ground, and the east wind dried her fruit. Her strong branches were broken and withered. The fire consumed them, and now she is planted in the wilderness, in a dry and thirsty land. Fire has come out from a rod of her branches and devoured her fruit, so that she has no strong branch, a scepter for ruling. This is a lamentation and has become a lamentation.
Okay. So what we have to start with is says your mother was like a vine in a vineyard planted by the water. Remember, they have that image in a number of different places, do we not, in the scriptures? Think of Psalm 1, you know, the vine by the waters, and it's always fruitful and always bearing. And so, saying it started off good, started off in perfect conditions, perfect for growth, perfect for producing fruit. But something happened. What does 10, 11 tell us happened with it? I guess we're at 11. You understand what they're saying?
Got plucked up, thrown down.
All right, but why?
It got too big for itself.
Yeah. Well, pride. Yes, that's right. You know, you think, oh, look what I've done. You know, Nebuchadnezzar is a great example. There's not a king of Israel, obviously, but, you know, he looks over his kingdom and he says, look what I have done with my hands. I've made this great kingdom. And of course, God brought him low very fast and that from it. But on a lesser scale, we are all subject to that temptation and that danger of looking and falling to that. And that's what we find here. It says, they're strong and tall, but then the pride really takes over. I thought it was an interesting thing too. It says its strong stems became ruler scepters. So at first, you know, vine, you talk about a vine, what good's a vine for? And you have this imagery in other places, you know, it's not, you can't build things really with a vine much unless you're going to weave them, that type of thing. It's not a strong wood. But here, this vine was doing so well that it could even be used as a scepter, as a staff by the kings. But, you know, it was plucked up and thrown into the ground, and the east wind came and withered it and consumed it by fire. And then the remains taken and planted in the wilderness, which is Babylon. This is a prediction of the exile, or a comment of the exiles. You are a vine, you are there by God, you were created by Him and put into place, but you became proud, you didn't follow God, didn't trust Him, and what happened? You're taken, you know, chopped down and this, but then taken, and you're replanted, but it's in exile, it's in another country. That's the image he's laying out here for them. So he's really talking about them at this point, that group of exiles that are there and taken into and planted into Babylon. Okay? Is this, though, going to be the end of the reign of David?
No.
It may look like it, and it's going to be, but it is not. And if you go back to that chart that I had on the other side of your page there, you look down that chart and you have the descendants of the people who are taking the throne. We'll look at this more in detail later on, but these kings, you know, Joaz, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, then Zedekiah was the uncle of Jehoiachin, still in that family line. But then after that, Babylon comes in, and they put a fellow in to rule over them called Jedaliah. He was not a descendant, but he never was classified as the king. He was a governor. They did not have a king on the throne at that point. Following that. So after Zedekiah, there was, you know, you do not have that really until you have the time of Christ. So we have a long time before that comes back to us. We come back to a king that's there. Okay? Zedekiah was appointed the governor, we find that in 2 Kings 25:22, by Babylon. It said he was a good man. He was the son of Ahikam, who was the son of Stephan, who had been the secretary of state under Josiah. I think I have all this in your notes, I'll put that for you. He had brought the book of the law to Josiah back in chapter 22. He had rescued Jeremiah from death in Jeremiah 26, you can read about that. He was totally committed to God. He gave good advice to the remnant in Jerusalem, but not to be afraid. He told them not to be afraid, but to accept the situation that they were in, trust God in it. Do not rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, but are to yield to his yoke. It's what really David and Nehemiah had done. And it says, but if they would do so, then they would not just survive, but they could even thrive. But they rejected his advice, and he was assassinated. They assassinated Jedaliah. I'm not sure anybody entrusted in Egypt. Tried to trust in Egypt to overthrow Babylon instead of looking to the Lord. So you see what happens. He put this one is there. He's a good good advice, good guidance, but they don't want it. And in 7 months they rebel against him. And so here's the case. And there were 10 of them, 10 conspirators who did it. So it wasn't a total uprising of the nation, but it was a group there who had him killed and brought an end to it. So we find that though there was a when somebody came up and tried to give godly advice, what's happened? You know, the people, instead of taking that, or the powers that be, instead of taking that, they still want to look to Egypt in this case, or in fact to Babylon, somewhere else, instead of trusting God to provide and see them through.
I kind of lost the timeline here a
okay.
little bit.
I'm sorry.
When was he ruling?
Okay, he is at the very end.
Right, but I mean time-wise, okay. before, at okay. what point in the exile?
Okay, this would be after the third exile. I guess it's going into the third exile. I believe that's right. So it's point, Zedekiah.
Yeah, between the second and third.
Yeah, between the second and the third.
The second and third, okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me bring that thought with me here. Yes. Thank you for asking that.
In the context okay. for this chapter, too, Ezekiel is preaching to the elders, isn't he?
He's preaching to the elders in exile, the ones who are in exile, about the situation back in Jerusalem, where Jedidiah is in Jerusalem. So it's not talking to the people there. Now, Jedidiah was trying to give advice to the people there, saying we need to submit to this authority that's over us, trust that God will allow us to thrive even in the midst of it and restore us in his timing. But they refused to listen to him. And they try to trust in Egypt in time, which irritates Nebuchadnezzar. He comes in on the third invasion, and that's when everything is destroyed. Right. So we have this kind of this change of pace a little bit here in chapter 19. This allegory is reflecting back some of the things we've already looked at. We're running a little bit of a risk here, and I apologize somewhat doing this because I keep kind of pointing us ahead because we know what's coming, and that's not always good, but it's kind of hard not to, to see a little bit what's going on there. But we see in both of these cases, both these allegories, the lioness, and he puts another king in, they just keep doing wrong. The vine, the same thing happens, and even when Jedidiah comes in as the one who wants to do right, the people reject it. Evil is just permeating through the land at this point. Okay, on your sheet that I gave to you, I had a question I highlighted there in the yellow. Maybe we've already talked a little bit about it, but I think it's good. How can this advice be applied to Christians who find themselves in a secular culture, secular environment? Is there anything of advice to us? In our world, our nation today.
Well, we have to obey the earthly authorities as long as they don't force us to break God's law.
Okay. Can we do that and still trust God? I think that's part of the question. Can you obey a secular rulers and still trust God? You've answered part of that in a sense, but
Paul would affirm that.
Mm-hmm. So there may be times when we have to stand up and say no, and that, but we are not only can we do it, but we are supposed to do it, as long as he has not caused us to trust God, which is what Don was saying, is very important. Now, I put a few more things there below that. God is still sovereign. We've already prayed it this way earlier tonight, but he does continue to protect and preserve his people. And we need to always trust him. I think that can become a hard lesson for us. We know that God is sovereign, but when things seem to be spiraling out of control and going from worse to worse, we start to look for escapes or ways to deal with it without God instead of trusting him and what he's going to do in it. And as human beings, that's very, very common for us to do. As Christians, though, we need to fight against that and to make sure we are always trusting God.
I guess that's really a fine line, just trying to figure out, as Christians, what it is we are to do. Mm-hmm. If you have a governor that tells you, your church cannot meet anymore, you just can't meet. Now, we know how some have reacted to that, some closed their doors. And what has it done to the church itself? I think it's really harmed the church, because without the fellowship of the church, a lot of people say, "Well, I can do church at home. I don't need all that stuff." I mean, that's not church.
That's right.
You know, we need the fellowship. I mean, it's just like having an opportunity to come with y'all tonight. I feel so much better being here tonight than being stuck at home. And,
with me?
No offense.
I know where you're going.
It does. It just really feels like. And then I go to work and I'm just thinking, God, you know, I need to get a break. You know, be around some people I feel like I can talk to.
Okay, you're going to be digging yourself out.
Well, the other thing, when we look at the church today, or what some people call churches, they're doing just what these people did. You've got a wicked leader, and they're just following along. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of church, well, I say they call themselves churches, but they'll, you know, follow the gay agenda and all of this social justice and, you know, all of this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And the church is just going along like, oh, yeah, that sounds good, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing that's happening there. You get a wicked king, people just follow along and say, oh, yeah, that's good.
They're not going to be blameless, just like the people as a whole weren't. The church,
well judgment was brought on them.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why it won't come on us.
That's right.
Well, you know, even if it's just the church, let's say you got a business that they told you got to shut down. You know, you can't work anymore. And, I mean, what do you do? I mean, just go hide in a cave or something, wait till the king comes tell you it's okay, you come out now, we'll let you come out. It just gets to the point where, I don't know, something has to end somewhere. I mean, either we live in a country where we live by the rule of law and our constitution, or the people can just make up stuff out of thin air. Well, we're not going to obey these rules anymore. I got some new ones here. We're going to obey these now. So get your mask on.
Well, it's in the secular area, but a wise man once said that if you're seeking freedom, if you give up freedom for security, you'll get neither.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That is true.
But, you know, that's the biggest thing, is just getting, you know, understanding what we're doing. Because we want to get ahead of God, just saying. I mean, you see what happens when we get ahead of God. We just make a total mess out of it. And we just want to make sure that we're doing what, you know, brings glory to Him. Sometimes that's tough in our situation, because, you know, when we see an injustice or something, we want to rebel against it right now, you know, realizing that God is going to be the one who's going to, He'll be the one setting up the judgment.
Right.
Is there any indication, maybe I missed it, how God was dealing with the remnant at this point? I mean, there were people that were still trusting God.
Right.
And He had a remnant. Mm-hmm. What was happening with them?
Okay.
In all of this?
Good question. That's actually where I want to go at the end of this, for a little bit of that. And what pretty much appears is that in Jerusalem, there is no remnant left at all at the end of it. The remnant is in exile, and then they're going to be restored and then sent back. Now, is that 100% nobody or not? I don't know that, but as far as the thing, and that's coming later. Ezekiel hasn't gotten to that point yet for us. But we do have some pictures of that, a little bit of that. And even in Kings, you have it. And if you know, I mentioned that we're looking at what parallels to 2 Kings 23, 24, and 25. And Jehoiachin, you look at that chart again if you need to, but he was taken captive into Babylon and was in captivity there in Babylon for many years. And then an interesting thing took place. He was an evil king. Did not deserve God's favor at all, and yet God still did something good for him. And it's not like it was with what was his name, the uncle Zedekiah. You know, he was had followed Jehoiachin and then reigned for 11 years, and then when he was captured, he was taken and he's sons were all killed in his presence, and then they put his eyes out. So the last thing he saw was his sons being killed, and then he died in the exile. Well, Jehoiachin, and the writer of 2 Kings says Now, it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiachin, so 37 years later now, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiachin, king of Judah, from prison. And he spoke kindly to him, and set his throne above the throne of the kings who were with him in Babylon. Jehoiachin changed his prison clothes, and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life. And for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. So here he is, a wicked king. He's been taken to exile. He's in prison for 37 years. And the new king takes the throne, and he likes him for some reason. He releases him, and he has him come and eats with him, and that, you know. So he's still in exile, but he's now not in prison anymore. As I said, it's one of those things that we see God sometimes blesses where blessing isn't deserved. And there's nothing Jehoiachin ever did. There was no conversion or anything about him that we know of, at least. And that, he was, the evil king. And yet God still blessed him in the sense of him getting out of prison and then with not only eating with the king, but was given allowance to live on for the rest of his life. And that, so.
And we have to assume that after his release from prison, he married and had children. Because Jesus is a descendant of
his. Yes, is. Now, whether that was, I guess that was afterwards. We don't know.
Well, it said he was taken into exile as a teenager.
Right. He was, so probably.
Was Zerubbabel's grandfather.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, he had Zerubbabel, who was the, and never was put in the king, but basically the leader of the people when they came back at the beginning of the end of the exile. He's his grandson. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. So it probably did come later. You know, that's, we have to, we're assuming some things. I mean, as a teenager, he could have had children already. We don't know for sure on that. So, my point is that, you know, we make the statements that we believe that God is sovereign. He's in control of things. We make the statement that all things work together for the good of those that love the Lord and called according to His will. That God works things for His people and cares for them and will provide for them. He promises to do that. Do we really believe it? Do we live like we believe it when things go bad? Are we still going to keep trusting God, or are we going to trust somewhere else or do something else? That's the temptation that is before us in our culture today, and maybe in our very own lifetime right now, more than we've ever faced before as in this country. We don't know what's going to happen in the next few days or weeks, but something's going to. Yeah. We'll see where it goes. What are we going to do with it?
The only thing I know to do about that is to pray that the Lord will intervene. Because I don't know any way we can stop that from happening. And
that's a good point.
That's what we have. I guess that when we talk about trusting God, we have to trust Him to keep us from that evil. Because I don't know any other way we can do it.
Right.
The same thing with this business about insurance companies having to pay for insurance that will provide abortions for their employees. And so right now that's, I don't believe it's being forced on us, but it's one of the things that's on the list.
Yes.
Yeah, I was reading I was looking at a video series Erwin Lutzer had about the church in Babylon. You know, the church living in Babylon itself. And he was talking about a lot of the same people, Ezekiel and Isaiah, were going through this. And one of the things they talked about, one of the bookmark things, I guess, was in 73 when Roe versus Wade happened. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, what was going on then that just somehow or another killing children was a good idea? I don't understand what the.
Well, the women's rights movement was popular during, right around that time.
Well, I know the left has a way of putting words pro-choice as opposed to pro-abortion or that. I mean, they have a way of dressing it up where it doesn't. What you think you're getting and you're not getting.
But you have some of that, and like I said, you have them wanting to appease this group or that group, and so sometimes legislation gets slipped in on us, or
it's been the same thing now. I mean, you look now, we've got the change of marriage, what marriage is, and then now we're having things where we're having, men and women competing in the same sport. I mean, it's just driving me nuts, and it's like, well, there's no difference between the two of them. Well, yes, there is.
Don't you believe you're lying to us?
I mean, I had a trip the other day where that all the news people were in such an uproar that a woman was kicking off with Vanderbilt. She kicked the ball 10 yards. What the heck's that about?
I think it was 30.
I mean, they're like 20 yards. Yeah. I mean, everybody's player of the week. I'm going to be player of the week.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, we another example is this whole thing with the Black Lives Matter. You know, you have it. Who amongst us would not say, yes, we believe that Black Lives Matter, just like white lives, all lives matter, that type of thing. But you can't say that. You know, it's got to be Black Lives, and yet the movement itself has nothing to do with that. You know, it's a Marxist movement. And it's just that deception and that lying, perpetual lying that if you try to bring that out, then you, even though they say that on their own webpage,
you get canceled.
You get canceled out of you.
Sweeps you under the rug. In fact, there's a paganism. Behind that too, a spiritualism that's just very repugnant. We're seeing the same thing though in the church.
Satan is a master of deception, and that force. You're right.
You know, the problem is, the public now is embracing a lot of this, what do you call it, social justice.
Yes.
And they're thinking it's a good thing. I mean, you see these basketball players now got these signs on the back, equality and all that. And I mean, equality by itself is no problem. I mean, we had these words in our school for a long time. Tolerance, political correctness, multiculturalism, all those things were in our school. And all the rules have been thrown out. So tolerance is now the rule. So Johnny's over beating the tar out of somebody else. It's okay. Johnny's just venting.
Expressing himself.
He's having a problem. It ain't no big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, when you do away with truth and law, you'll have anarchy. And that's where we are.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's another thing, too, when we're talking about this.
What do we do?
That's election.
It's hard to
pray for these people.
This election is not solved. I mean, really, our election
don't mean anything. And we say, well, that's not enough. That's more than enough. If we pray, and the Lord will answer our prayer in a way that is going to be helpful.
If we need to pray, and we need to continue to trust God and not try to find other answers. You know, we can't look to the president or to the governor or, to man, any kind of format whatsoever to be the answer to it. Now, that doesn't mean we don't try to elect the best people we can and that, but God's, we want God to change people's hearts.
But we have to continue to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Right.
The church has been silent for so long.
Yes, we've got to tell the truth.
Well, there's
stand on the truth.
Love. The part of the church, not the right part, but whatever, called the church these days, are busy embracing Jesus calling and the shack and all of these interesting cultural sidetracking, whatever. So, I mean,
but even good
they're going to have a
people
hard
aren't
time
even sharing their faith anymore.
A lot of that's mysticism.
It's, it's private. It's, it's, that's not what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not laughing at what you're saying. That's not what I mean. I'm just finally, for those of us that are extroverts, we have an opportunity to blast out with what the Lord wants us to say. It's time to go ahead and do it and not be embarrassed. And And it's amazing the ways that you can find to do it if you just open your mouth. And since I put my foot into my mouth so many other times, it shouldn't be a problem for me.
It's real well done. Well, and being reformed too, there's a lot of liberty there because it's like, okay, yeah, I know that I'm fallible, but Lord, you just take it and use it.
Yeah.
And you just make sure that you have the right attitude and go for it.
Well, you know, that's what Susan was talking about. We've had some friends of ours that, you know, they promote different things. And we try to correct them. Say, listen, what you're looking at is really not biblical or it's heresy in the Bible. You know, but really, when you're doing that, you're attacking them because they have just promoted that this is the greatest thing, so slash bread. And now you're telling them that this is heresy in the Bible. And then you kind of be kind of thoughtful. You know, well, who are you to tell us what's, you know, and then you try it. And really, the format we're using is not really the best thing. You know, face to face, being able to do things, look at the Bible would be the best. But I mean, when you sit there and if you try to correct them, well, you're going to draw the arrows real fast, like.
Yeah. Okay. So I think this chapter has a lot of application for us in our. Very relevant to our day and time. And are we going to trust God? We have an example of God, how even with Jehoiachin, he restores them that deserve it. Well, he has promised us that he will care for his people. And his church is going to be here. Not every church, not every group, but the church, the true church is going to be here when Christ comes back and be in its fullness. And that, those ought to be words that really encourage us to remain faithful, to be praying, to be witnessing, and living the Christian life, living the truth, and declaring the truth and living it. Okay? Let me close this in prayer. Father, we thank you for the opportunity to look at this chapter from Ezekiel to tonight. And it's an interesting allegorical chapter, but Lord, it is one that does speak, I think, to us, and particularly just right now. In our country and some of the turmoil that's going on and what way it goes and what's going to happen, we don't know, but Lord, you do. You are the sovereign God. And we may we trust in you and look to you, may we be faithful to you and declaring the truth and witnessing for you and speaking up, Father, and also living out a life that shows Jesus Christ is the Lord of our lives. And we pray, Father, for your blessings to be upon us and upon our nation. And Lord, that we ask that truth might prevail and that you would indeed work through all these things and that you would strengthen your church and that your church may grow. I pray in Jesus' name.